from Podcast One.
Coming up in this episode of Target USA. There are more than 10,000 spies in Washington.
Unprecedented, the threat from our foreign adversary, specifically China, on the economic espionage, on the espionage front.
Who are they? What are they after? Brian Dugan, Assistant Special Agent in charge of counterintelligence at the FBI's Washington field office, joins us on this episode to put the problem into context, explain who's behind it, and where the FBI is going to solve it. Coming up on this edition of Target USA,
the National Security Podcast.
From WTOP in Washington, D.C., this is Target USA. Russia
could render huge harm to this country.
North Korea's secret missile,
capable of reaching the whole of the United States.
Dangerous terrorist.
D.C. is repeatedly mentioned as someplace they would like to seek an attack.
Cyber criminals.
Decryption successful.
America has a target on its back. And on this program, we investigate the threats, the people behind them, the agencies fighting them, and the impact on you. This is Target USA,
the National Security Podcast.
I'm J.J. Green. U.S. intelligence officials believe there are thousands of spies lurking in Washington. Some say as many or more than 10,000. And many of them are operating in plain sight in what we call the City of Secrets.
The next station, DuPont, sir.
Every day, in the pre-dawn hours, the quiet rumble of transit begins deep beneath the city, in the streets, on its waterways, and in the skies. Hour by hour, it grows as this city of 700,000 swells to more than a million. Waves of civil servants, military, law enforcement officers, business people, students, and diplomats, and tourists saturate the city. Among them, spies, and a lot of them.
Unprecedented, the threat from our foreign adversary, specifically China, on the economic espionage, on the espionage front.
Brian Dugan, Assistant Special Agent in charge of counterintelligence at the Washington field office of the FBI.
There's a lot of activity in the D.C. area, and in our current climate, there's a lot of people interested in finding out what the U.S. government is up to.
That's not the only reason. There's also one of the biggest workforce turnovers in the history of this nation.
There's a large population right now in retirement or getting close to retirement. The baby boomers that were in U.S. government are all leaving, and that population is also looking for post-government jobs.
And according to Philip Mudd, former deputy director of the FBI's National Security Division, they know things.
People with high-end security clearances at the State Department, the CIA, the FBI, the Department of Defense, and contractors in Washington.
They number, according to Mudd, in the tens of thousands. And if you do the numbers...
In that numbers game, I just think of the insider threat here. And you got to know that at any one time, someone has given it up for money or some other reason and just got to hope that the counterintelligence guys figure it out.
And according to Dugan, they pretty much have. And they're taking action.
Working with our federal partners to make the awareness out there for those that are getting ready to retire that we provided some really good training to you. We provided really good access for you. But this is not for sale.
And for those who reject, miss, or ignore the message.
Of course, there's always going to be moments that we're going to have people decide to cooperate with the enemy. And we're going to find them, we're going to catch them.
And now, we get down to the conversation with Brian Dugan on Washington's spy problem and what the FBI is doing about it.
Why is Washington such an important target?
Well, I mean, Washington is, one, the seat of government. We have all of our foreign partners all here at the embassies. We also have a large number of retired government employees that are retiring out of the government here. We also have headquarters of our partner federal agencies centered around the Capital District, as well as a lot of contracting companies. And there are subcontractors that are also headquartered in the D.C. area, all working on classified projects that are all vulnerabilities for the U.S. government.
Mm-hmm. So would you just give us a brief overview about the counterintelligence division here at the Washington Field Office and what your mission is and your objectives are?
Okay. So our counterintelligence division is one of the larger ones in the FBI. We concentrate on monitoring our foreign adversaries to make sure that the playing field is level between our U.S. policy and objectives, and to also ensure that our companies and U.S. economy is playing a level of field in regard to economic espionage, as well as to ensure that those that are working in the classified environment are secure, that classified information is not being provided to the foreign adversary or foreign counterparts that don't have a need to know. And it's a full-time business. There's a lot of activity in the D.C. area, and in our current climate, there's a lot of people interested in finding out what the U.S. government is up to, what technologies our companies, our universities, our federal partners are working on that give the U.S. the edge, the leadership in the world. And our job is to keep an eye on that to make sure that nothing escapes the confines of our interests.
Mm-hmm. Two things I'd like to follow up on. The first one being, you said it's important to keep a level playing field when it comes to foreign intelligence organizations, I guess. How do you do that?
Well, the intelligence game is something that obviously, you know, all countries are involved in. And we're basically the defense. We're the defensive agency here to make sure that the intelligence games by our adversaries, we keep them in check. We catch them in their craft. We catch them in trying to recruit people in the United States, and also if they're trying to recruit people outside the United States that are willing or possibly able to provide an advantage to our foreign adversary. And so that's a full-time job, and we've had some recent successes in that game.
Could you give us a sense of some of those successes?
So more recently, Kevin Mallory was finally fully adjudicated, was featured on 60 Minutes. It's an example of the large population of retired U.S. government employees that have had either past clearances, current clearances in retirement, or even just U.S. government employees that have information that our foreign adversaries would like to have. Mr. Mallory decided that 5 years after retirement, he needed to make extra money, and he made his services available to the Chinese. Mm-hmm. We caught him. He was convicted of espionage and ultimately sentenced.
The Kevin Mallory situation, how long did it take to work that out, to get to the bottom of that?
It was actually relatively a short case. Usually espionage cases take years. But in that specific case, it took months, where between the time of recognizing something was going afoul to catching him in the act, catching his conversations on his phone with his handler, were actually done in months. It made it hard in the case to prove the transmission of classified material. But ultimately, we were successful in showing that he was cooperating with the Chinese.
Do you think that was unusual, the fact that that was such a short case, based on what you were saying about cases, or is each case, you know, unique?
Each case is unique, but certainly the Mallory case was unique in itself, that things were so fast-moving with technology and the speed of the recruitment and the people that are willing to talk to our foreign adversary handlers. We're having to speed things up. Mm-hmm. Gone are the days of meeting handlers once in a while, where we have Mallory talking on a regular basis with his handler electronically and what he thought was going to be hidden conversations. We are able to catch that and move on that quicker.
Mm-hmm. You said that there is a lot of activity here in this area. How do you gauge that? How do you tell that? What gives you that impression?
Well, one thing that has not just piqued our interest, but brought to our attention a lot more in the last 10 years or so, is as America's been talking about, there's a large population right now in retirement or getting close to retirement. And the baby boomers are, you know, that were in U.S. government are all leaving. And those that population is also looking for post-government jobs. And they've been provided good training. They've been provided good access to information. So they have a lot of information. Even if they don't have copies of stuff they had from work like Mr. Mallory, they still have stuff up in their heads that is something that the Chinese, the Russians, or others may be interested in having. Even if it's as innocuous as just how the U.S. government operates or how the government views another country, is something that the intelligence services that are coming against the United States would be interested in having. And so all those people, and we're getting the word out, and we're working with our federal partners to make the awareness out there for those that are getting ready to retire that we provided some really good training to you. We provided really good access for you, but this is not for sale. And that's some of the lessons hopefully we're coming out with the Mallory resolution, and now we've got Jerry Lee, another former intelligence community member that has pled guilty to his crimes working with the Chinese.
That's pretty remarkable what you mentioned, that the adversaries are looking at the demographics here, the population age thing, and figuring and working that out, saying, hey, there is this many people or that many people that are going to be 57 or whatever the age is and are going to be looking for work, and maybe we can sweeten the pot for them. That's pretty remarkable if they're thinking that way.
Well, I think, you know, social media has made it easier for them to find. You know, you can look on any, you know, LinkedIn is one example, but any social media employment search facilitating mechanism on social media, people put out there, if not what they did in a prior life, what skills they have. And to any good intelligence service, those are going to be clues to find people that used to have a government job or access to a clearance at one time or another. And so that just makes it more out there. Obviously, that's something that if an American is retired and they're trying to find a job that correlates to what they've been working on, headhunters out there may be legitimately looking for people with those backgrounds. But our adversary is also using that as a means to look for and recruit potential people to talk to them.
Mm-hmm. Could you characterize, and I know you've talked a little bit about the activity, you just got done talking about the kind of activity we're seeing here, but could you characterize the threat now, severe, moderate, mild, comparatively speaking to recent years?
Well, I think in the 60 Minutes interviews, I think you couldn't say it any better than Assistant Attorney General Demers and then Mr. Evanita, where they basically both said that it's unprecedented, the threat from our foreign adversary, specifically China, on the economic espionage, on the espionage front, that there's such a desire for our foreign adversaries to gain access to classified information, to U.S. government intentions. And I think the large population is not something that's being calculated by our foreign intelligence service adversaries, but I think it's just a vulnerability that we in the U.S. government have that we're aware of, and it's just their luck that it's becoming available.
Hmm. Couple of, well, your former assistant director here told me some months ago, and another national security official just this week confirmed it to me, that China has been really active, obviously, and they suggested that the U.S. may have some work to do to catch up to them, to get ahead of the threat. So how would you characterize what needs to be done or what is being done to deal with that significant threat that you just outlined from the Chinese?
Certainly. As Mr. Demers had laid out in some of his testimony in the last year, we're getting working groups together that'll go cross government agencies to make sure that, one, the outreach to not only our federal partners about the internal risk and the retiree risk, but also to our corporate partners to educate on the risk that the enemy is looking for any and all opportunities to collect information about the U.S. government, the U.S. intelligence community, and U.S. government, or excuse me, U.S. company secrets, and advantage R&D, technology, and our academic sector. So we are in full court press with outreach to get the education out there. And the audience is open to listening about this more and more these days because they see the transfer of technology, the transfer of information, and companies are seeing their bottom line slip because it used to be we wanted to have openings into the market, and the Chinese government controls their own economy, whereas the United States is, the economy is on its own and the government's on its own, and there's a separation for good reason. But we don't have spies, as Mr. Demers said, stealing secrets from other foreign companies to give to Google. Google has to do their own thing. But in China, the Communist Party is going to support their own companies. And so this is not just a FBI versus the Chinese government. This is a whole of government, the whole of the United States, to work together to protect our own bottom line, our own interests, and our own secrets.
Can spies slip through in here in Washington? Because you guys cover this place like a blanket, and you're very busy. I mean, there's a lot going on. Can they slip through?
Of course, there's always going to be moments that we're going to have people decide to cooperate with the enemy, and we're going to find them. We're going to catch them. Like I said, it's just not the FBI. It's not just the U.S. government keeping an eye out in the watchtower. It is everybody involved that we get our defense contractors on the lookout. We have their subcontractors that work with them on the lookout. We have active engagement with multiple fronts in the private sector, academic sector. So it's not just one agency or just one government that's doing this. We are all doing it in partnership to make sure that we don't let things slip by.
You know, it's really interesting here, getting back to Washington. You know, it's a city of 700,000 people, I think. And recently, I think it was the Spy Museum, had an advertisement that said that there are 10,000 spies here, which means that there's one in every 70 people could be a spy, which, you know, it is what it is. But for the average Joe or Susie, what does a spy look like?
A spy, you know, is nondescript. A spy is going to be someone that's going to be a student in school, a visiting professor, your neighbor, someone that could be a colleague, or someone that shares the soccer field with you. There's ample evidence that our foreign adversary is coming at us in person and over the internet. And we all have to be watchful. I can't put a number on how many spies are amongst us right now, but we're always vigilant. And the good thing is that even our local partners, working with local, state, tribal police, they understand the counterintelligence mission as well. And so we're all looking out for who's the next spy.
Mm-hmm. The question about what they do or how they do what they do is very interesting. How's the tradecraft changed? I know you've spoken a little bit about LinkedIn and social media and mm-hmm. stuff, you know, remote stuff, but, you know, people on the ground. One thing that some years ago that was pointed out is that you know, the non-conventional way of going after this. Some nation states are doing that now. Instead of, you know, government people, they're getting, as you mentioned, different people from different disciplines to come here to do things, like business people and students. Mm-hmm. So how's the tradecraft changed?
Well, I mean, the tradecraft is still building relationships, no matter who it is. It's based off of building trust and getting people to talk and share. And so it's not just a person in the sunglasses and dark hat and the trench coat. Our adversary is becoming better at co-opting people in all walks of life for either reasons of threat or financial gain. There are people here in the United States that are looking to find out what the United States is doing, what we're about, and they're going to collect that and provide that back to their handlers. Mm-hmm. And so there's a benefit in the United States that we're open, and so that's always going to have a vulnerability for us, but that's why the FBI, our federal partners, and all the people that we have great relationships with will be watching for to make sure that while we have an open society, that we also keep an eye on, or keep an eye out for those people that have nefarious purposes here.
How long have you been involved in counterintelligence?
I've been involved in counterintelligence about half of my career, both here and on the West Coast.
So it's my understanding that FBI agents usually have a previous career before coming into the FBI. Was that the case with you?
An intelligence career?
No, just a previous job, you know, before coming to the FBI.
So FBI agents have to have work experience before they can sign up. You can't come into the FBI straight out of college. So we have police officers, we have lawyers, we have Marines like myself. We have people that had been FBI employees either as analysts or else in the FBI, and they try out for agent and they had that work experience wherever they came from. But the FBI is getting younger, and we have younger and younger agents starting to work counterintelligence. But they're learning fast, and they're going fast. Mm-hmm. And I'm really proud of our organization able to train up and develop these young investigators to do things that older generations used to do, and they're doing a great job.
So the reason I asked you that question, I wanted to know if there is anything that strikes you or moment in your career when it comes to counterintelligence that you kind of sit back and think, wow, that was great. We did great work. Is there a case that's more memorable to you than any other, or any that strikes you as something that you just remember?
I mean, there's a lot of victories. There's a lot of ongoing victories that I don't know if I can even talk about right now. I mean, that's the neat thing about counterintelligence is there's things that go on with us and our government partners that we are stopping the counterintelligence threat, and not all the time does it show up in court. And I'm really proud of what our folks are doing. As Mr. Demir said in his testimony, we're partnering up with other federal agencies like Treasury, where we're using financial means to stop the enemy from stealing technology, because we're not going to be able to arrest them. We're not going to be able to stop them from getting technology. So then we hit them in the pocketbook.
Mm-hmm. So what haven't I asked you about that you think is important?
The one thing that I think when I was thinking about talking to you today is the not just outreach to the private sector, but our work with our federal partners to better train them and better open up the bridge for communication to identify those insider threats earlier and more often. It's not for any one of our agencies, and even the FBI is included, it's not a black mark that you have someone that's doing bad things in your agency or your department. It's more important to identify them and out them and get them out of the access they have currently. And I think some of the work that our headquarters, insider threat and espionage people have been doing have been preparing our federal partners for the event of there's going to be a bad apple, but this is how you can identify them. This is how you can refer them to us so we can jointly look at them and make sure we don't let any more secrets go and stop the leak from continuing.
And how would you characterize the reception you're getting from these places and people and organizations that you're going to try to teach them up about this?
Very receptive. I think our partners, so in each federal agency, we have equal personnel that are working insider threat for each of the federal agencies, especially in the intelligence community, that we can reach to, and they understand that their mission is to look for the insider threat and that they can contact us anytime. I think that is mutually beneficial for everybody, and it is well received, and it's not a black mark on the agency to identify them, and we get to them and get to them quickly, and we take care of the issue as fast as we can.
The city of Washington itself, it's a very unique city. It is very diverse. Mm-hmm. There are lots of different neighborhoods, lots of different places where people who are engaged in and involved in international espionage can hide. You know, you have diplomats who live all over the place, mm-hmm. Not just in the city. So how do you view that? How do you manage those possibilities? Or is that something you simply rely on your partnerships for to deal with that kind of thing?
Well, I mean, that's the advantage about living in the United States, is that there is that freedom of movement, freedom to live wherever you want. In a lot of ways, that's our advantage. When we talk to the adversary, they see the lifestyle and the living conditions. So as much as that makes our job harder in some ways, it also is to our advantage. And so that there is different communities, different ethnicities, different cultures throughout the city in the greater D.C. area, including in Maryland and into Virginia, that also is our advantage. And so in a lot of ways, that helps us. And, yes, it makes our job we have to open up the optic to keep an eye on out there. But we have really good people in the organization, good people that can speak multiple languages, can understand different cultures, and work with all these different entities and communities throughout the greater D.C. area to help look for nefarious actors and then bring them to our attention.
The odd nature of recruitment sometimes may escape people, but you have some thoughts about how people should view some of those developments.
Well, as I mentioned, part of our outreach and training to people outside the FBI, to our federal partners, to the private sector, is that the collectors for a foreign intelligence service will try to befriend you. They're going to try to lure you into a relationship, but they're going to start asking odd questions. And those questions at the beginning will seem innocuous, maybe even flattering, but they're going to get to the point where they're going to try to get the information that they're looking for. And you know, the social engineering, the social work that a good handler is going to do is to ingratiate themselves to their person they're trying to recruit. And we're trying to make people aware, for those that are unwitting or not aware of the process, that over-eagerness to socialize with you may not be just because you're a swell person. It may be because of the information that you know or have access to. And to be wary of that social interaction, but also those questions that may be coming shortly after.
Well, sir, that's a great opportunity to talk to you today. It's been a pleasure to listen and learn, and I thank you for taking time to do this.
Thank you for your time.
That was Brian Dugan, Assistant Special Agent in Charge of Counterintelligence at the Washington Field Office of the FBI. This interview was for a series of reports that we called City of Secrets, and you can read all about it online at WTOP.com. That's Whiskey Tango Oscar Papa.com. And you can also listen to the individual radio reports right there at WTOP. When you go there, just search National Security. And coming up in our next episode, a woman that I describe as tough, smart, and funny. Her name, Elizabeth Horst. She's the chargé d'affaires at the U.S. Embassy in Tallinn, Estonia. And she's got a great story to tell.
As the chargé, I am in charge of the running of the embassy. I spend a good portion of the day working on the policy that we work on with the Estonians. And our primary goals here are security, economic development, and people-to-people relationships.
And she's had plenty of experiences in people-to-people relationships in some of the toughest postings in the world, including Pakistan, Afghanistan, and Moscow. So don't miss it. And with that, thank you as always for joining us. If you have any questions or comments, send me an email at jgreen@wtop.com. That's again, whiskeytangooscarpapa.com, WTOP. And you can follow us on Twitter at TUSA Podcast. That's at Tango Uniform Sierra Alpha Podcast, at TUSA Podcast. And check out our new national security newsletter called Inside the Skiff at WTOP.com/alerts.
I'm J.J. Green, and this is Target USA,
the National Security Podcast.
Hey, everybody. You have to check out this amazing new true crime podcast. It's called 22 Hours, An American Nightmare. It's about a murder that took place in Washington. A family and their housekeeper were held hostage for 19 hours before being killed when the murderer set their mansion on fire. And you'll be shocked by what they went through during those 19 hours. And you won't believe how they found the guy. I won't ruin the ending, but all I will say is pizza crust. Podcast One teamed up with my fellow award-winning journalists at WTOP, Megan Cloherty and Jack Moore, to put this story together. Download 22 Hours, An American Nightmare, on Apple Podcasts and Podcast One. New episodes every Monday.
Now, stay tuned for the latest headlines from the Associated Press.